I'm reading from James 1, 1 to 4. James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes scattered among the nations. Greetings. Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance. Let perseverance finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything.
I'll choose this one. Good morning. My name's Wendell. I'm very glad that Pastor Gary invited me to be here with you this morning. I want to bring you special greetings from Pastor Victor Estrada from Roca de Salvación, the church in Aurora where we meet. I want to tell a story this morning from the Old Testament, which I think Jesus might have commented about, as he did several times in the Gospels, where he said, "I thank you, Father, for keeping these things from the wise and showing them to simple children," because it's a story that delights children and it delights people who are in desperate straits. But to sensible adults who are living comfortably by exercising our self-sufficiency and our good sense, to us, it goes against our sense of propriety. And I'm going to start right out with the moral of the story, because there's not just one, there's at least three, and I just heard another one when we sang this morning. So I'm putting them out here right now so you can listen for them as we go through the story and decide, because each of us at the end is the one who decides which of these truths God is telling to you this morning. So here are three spiritual principles that I hear working in this story. One is our faith and our obedience opens the spaces for God's grace to work. And what I heard this morning in the hymn that we sang, which it says, trust and obey. What's the rest of the line? For there's no other way to be happy in Jesus. I want to rewrite that this morning. It says, trust and obey, for there's no other way to be useful to Jesus. There's no other way to be useful to Jesus. Okay. Two, God asks us sometimes to do things contrary to our understanding to test our faith in Him. And last, perseverance only comes to a faith that is matured through testing. Perseverance only comes to a life that is matured through testing. We're going to look this morning at a story in the book of 2 Kings, chapter 4. If you brought your Bible, I invite you to open it, and we're going to go through the story. It's a story that's well known. It's a story that we enjoy because miracle stories are ones we like to repeat. We like to recount them because miracles are physical proof of God's presence with His people. When hard things are happening to us, we need reassurances that God is still with us, that things are not hopeless, and there's nothing like a miracle to imprint on our mind that God was really present with us. It stamps our life indelibly. It's an experience that we never forget. Elisha was a prophet who lived in a community of prophets. We never read of his family. We never hear anything about his wife or his children. We only hear about Elijah, who was his teacher, and we hear a few words about his disciples and his followers. This group of prophets were not priests. They were not Levites, so they didn't receive any tithes or any part of the offerings in the temple. They were persons who were dedicated to inquiring about God's truth, whether that truth was favorable to the person who asked them about it or not. This loyalty to God's truth made them very unpopular with kings because you couldn't count on them to say what you needed them to say, which meant that they didn't get any support from the government either. They had a very precarious livelihood on the whole. This incident is about a prophet from Elisha's congregation, or rather, it's about his family, because the prophet had recently died, leaving his family deep in debt. The prophet's widow came to Elisha in desperation when her creditors announced to her that he was taking her two sons as indentured servants. According to the laws of the time, a creditor could take children from debtors to work off the debt. Moses' law gave debtors some hope of being set free in the Sabbath year or the year of Jubilee, so we can estimate that this prophet might have owed the equivalent of 7 years' work for two young men, which today means we're talking about between $400,000 and $500,000. When I think about that number in the context of this story, I start asking myself, how did this man of God fall so deeply into debt? Was he a spendthrift? Was he a poor administrator? Was he a ne'er-do-well? And then I ask, in the days before everybody had credit cards, who would loan an itinerant prophet $500,000? Had he found himself in the hands of a shyster, a loan shark, succumbed to compound interest? We don't know. Perhaps we don't need to know. Perhaps the right answer is the one Jesus gave when people asked him about the man born blind. They said, "Who sinned, him or his fathers?" And Jesus said simply, "Neither one." This happened so that the power of God could be displayed. In any case, Elisha doesn't ask the widow about it. Perhaps he already knows the story of his brother prophet. He only asked her, "So, how can I help you? What do you have in your house?" And the widow responds with the plain truth, "We don't have a thing in the house. We've only got one jar with a little bit of oil." If you look at verse 3 and 4 of chapter 1 in 2 Kings, Elisha's help is to give her instructions that border on the absurd. He says to the widow, "Go and ask all your neighbors to lend you empty jars, not just a few. Borrow all you can get. Then take them into your house with your boys, shut the door, and start pouring your oil into the borrowed jars. As soon as one fills up, set it aside and pour into the next." The widow leaves Elisha without another word, and the writer only tells us that she actually shut herself into the house with her boys and started to pour. Now I find myself asking, wait, isn't there something wrong with this picture? This woman is about to lose her two boys, her only hope for surviving as a widow because of their family's huge debt. And this prophet's solution for her is what? Borrow more? Can he be serious, or is this seriously bad advice? Who is going to loan this woman anything and hope to get it back? Would you borrow your favorite pots and pans to a woman who is in bankruptcy proceedings and whose only visible source of income is being hauled off to prison tomorrow? I don't think so. And then I think, what reasonable explanation is this woman going to give to her neighbors when they ask her what she needs so many jars for? I mean, I'm pretty sure that she's already worn out her welcome with all of her neighbors borrowing flour and sugar, begging for used clothes, probably offering to sell them her pots and pans and her furniture. Does this prophet have any idea how hard it's going to be for her to get people to lend her good jars? Yes, I think the prophet had a very good idea about that. First, they both belong to a community of prophets. In other words, she has a church. There are people who know her family that served the Lord with her husband, which is why she says to Elisha, you know he revered the Lord. Elisha knows that there will be brothers and sisters who will loan her jars with no prospect of ever getting them back. But Elisha has something else very clear. Elisha knows that if she will go out and search for those jars with simple faith and not with desperation, God will do something in response to her need. So Elisha gives her a job. He sends her out into the neighborhood on a mission, not on a wild goose chase, not to go running desperately from one neighbor to the next, not to beg for help, a job. Elisha doesn't explain to her how this is going to work out. She doesn't even ask. She rushes off to get started because she has no time to lose. This is about saving her sons, and this is about saving the reputation of her deceased husband. He gives her directions for doing something she can do about it, and she goes at it with the single-mindedness of a person too busy getting the job done to worry about what people are saying. Now, the Bible doesn't even mention exactly what she and her boys had to do that day. It doesn't say if they had to beg the neighbors, how long it took them, how many people turned them down. It doesn't say how many people didn't want to lend her good jars. All she could get was little jars, dirty jars, cracked jars. It doesn't say anything about that. It just mentions, matter-of-factly, that she gathered her sons and the jars into the house and shut the door. But I still think about that. It's still pretty clear to me that this woman has a faith that has been tested before. She's no passive believer, no hand-wringing victim of indecision, not this woman. She staked her last shot on Elisha's word because she was the wife of a prophet who had seen God work, and she was ready for action. That ability to carry through only comes from a faith that has been subjected to the test. That's what the Apostle James was talking about in our text for today, putting our faith to test, being willing to put our faith to test. But James goes even further. He tells us we should look forward to those tests as endurance training for our faith. And he says, I will repeat the text, consider it pure joy, brothers, when one of you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith develops perseverance. Perseverance must finish its work in you so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. This verse is so counterintuitive. Why would anyone look forward to being in the uncomfortable position of facing opposition or suffering uncertainty or suffering pain? Well, let me ask you the questions I've had to ask myself. Do you ever disappoint yourself by not following through on what you believe? Have you ever promised God to do something and then backed down when it actually came time to do it? In your spiritual life, do you suffer through high points of enthusiasm and low points of discouragement? I have. These are all conditions we suffer because our faith is too wimpy to pull us through all the way through adversity. It needs endurance training. Perhaps we haven't yet put that aspect of our faith to the test in order to develop the perseverance that James is talking about. It's not the kind of workout most of us plan on in our Christian life, because who likes taking tests? Nobody. But no one can be sure they are competent until they pass the test. The test, whether it's the nursing board test whether it's the marathon or whether it's the spiritual test in our life, is an outside confirmation that removes your doubt so you can get back to work. That's all a test is. It's somebody else saying, you did it, you got there, you pass. Spiritual testing is not a form of punishment. It's a truth teller. It's a confidence builder from the great teacher. So verse 5 says, so she went in and shut the door. In the dark of her house, she tipped up her old jar over a borrowed one that her son was handing her, and she started to drain it. She couldn't take her eyes off of that golden stream that was running down into that jar. Oil pouring out of her empty jar into other people's jars. She poured and she poured and she kept on pouring until into the jars that the boys kept putting in front of her. And then as the oil was coming up to the brim again of that jar, she says, quick, bring me the next one. And her son says, there aren't any more. She looks up surprised and glances back down to be sure the oil doesn't run over, but the oil has stopped. Her jar is dripping empty. The miracle is over. She runs back to the man of God to tell him what happened, since he hadn't told her what she was supposed to do next. He says, good. Now go sell the oil, pay off your debt, and you and your sons will live on all that's left over. So now she goes out to do the fun part. Now she has something to sell that everyone wants. The country is in a drought. There is no oil. It's scarce. Now she gets to make the deals. She gets to name the price. So that evening, when she's all done selling, after she went over to the loan shark to pay him off, when he was already making a deal on selling her two strapping young sons, at some point in that hectic, wonderful, amazing day, the thought comes to her, I should have borrowed more jars. Why didn't I get more jars? If I had gotten more jars, there would have been all full of that oil. It sounds crazy, but she's right. She's right. I've heard this story so many times, but never realized how this really works. According to the Bible, as soon as the borrowed jars were full, that is, as soon as the diligence and preparation that she brought before the Lord ran out, so did the oil. She had unwittingly measured the amount of oil that God could give to her. Because this miracle, like all miracles, is made possible by faith and by obedience. Her contribution was to gather empty spaces for God's provision so that he could fill them up. And it wouldn't do to grab more jars once she saw that the oil was starting to pour. That's not faith, that's greed. Her faith provoked this miracle, made this miracle possible by confidently confiding, by confiding expectantly in Elisha, and then going out on a limb to obey his crazy instructions. This story underlines for me the power of that very small part that we contribute to God's amazing work. The Gospels record several times where Jesus remarks that the sick person's faith was what made their healing possible. And conversely, he says he was not able to do miracles in his hometown because of their lack of faith. We all remember Peter's famous walk on the waves, because that one ended as soon as he doubted, as soon as he lost faith. And Jesus lamented, why did you doubt? But this story also reminds me of how often we limit God from doing great things around us simply by our lukewarm faith and our lack of obedience. So today, what is this story in 2 Kings really saying to you and to me? Do you feel God calling you to do something that just doesn't make sense to you? Is he asking you to disregard your normal thinking just because you trust his word? If so, this story says to you, follow this woman's simple faith. Confess your need to God with the firm decision to do whatever he directs you to do. Don't wait for him to unfold the plan, because he will only do that once the jars are full. Your job is to collect empty jars for him and start to pour out the little bit of oil that you have if you trust it to him. Is God showing you an area of your life that you've been limiting his grace by your lack of faith or your lack of obedience? Is there some clear instruction from him that you are ignoring or resisting or dreading? Is there a task that you've accepted to do for the Lord but are only doing it half-heartedly? Then God's saying, borrow recklessly. There will be an outpouring of his grace for you that is waiting only for your sincere confession and simple obedience. He's telling you this morning that he will fill as many jars as you bring to him from the people that are around you. And he will fill your need by multiplying your oil, your most scarce, precious resource, at the moment when you begin pouring it out in obedience. Or this morning, do you need to hear God's reassurance that patience and perseverance will be your prize if you accept his testing of your faith? Have you often wished that you had the steadiness and perseverance that some Christians show? God promises you that endurance to go through whatever your task requires if you allow him to test your faith. That is the promise in James 1:3. If you allow him to test you, he will give you perseverance. He has promised that he will never break us when we trust him to test us. He wants to make us into strong, confident students who are eager to learn and ready to work. Our job is to gather empty lives together so that God can fill them. He wants to start pouring your oil.